Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters. Let me introduce you to your host, farm broadcaster Ken Root from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Welcome. Another week of winter in Iowa. Didn't some of the meteorologists predict a mild winter? I saw an article this week that said the very cold winter we're having is proof the earth is getting hotter. I read it and didn't seem to be proof of anything to me. Today, I'm going to put more news into the show. Let me know what you like, hardcore agricultural information, or a mix of lighter stories with the fare of our daily broadcast. KenRoot@gmail.com is my email address, KenRoot@gmail.com. Or you can call BR549 to complain about Congress, the weather, or predict who will win the White House in 2020. Junior Sample is standing by. Yesterday, the USDA tried to get back to normal. However, at 11 a.m., they dumped all the grain reports at the same time, and most of the trade appeared to be like a dog with a mouthful of peanut butter. They just chewed and chewed, and nothing happened. Alan Brugler later released this commentary. Corn futures, he said, were lower despite bullish news from USDA, and that included the government cutting the corn yield last year by 2.5 bushels per acre, now moving it back to 176.4. That dropped production back to 14.42 billion bushels. And after several balance sheet revisions, he said the 18-19 ending stocks were trimmed by 46 million bushels to 1.735 billion. That is significantly below the feared 2 billion bushel number that USDA has had in years past. On the bear side, the world-ending stocks were projected at just under 310 million metric tons. That was up 1 million metric tons from December. USDA left the Brazilian production number at 94.5 million metric tons of corn. Argentina at 46 million, they were up 3.5 million. The Ukrainian firm ProAgro estimates that the country's 2019 corn crop will be 31.2 million metric tons, down about 4.5 million from last year. Corn on the Chicago Board of Trade finished the day at 374 and a quarter for March, down 2 and a quarter, and December 399 and a quarter, down 1. Soybean futures yesterday fell 1 to 1.75 cents on most of the contracts. The USDA's NAS production number showed U.S. soybean yield at 51.6 bushels per acre. They dropped that 0.5 bushel from the November status and below most estimates. That dropped production to 4.54 billion bushels, still an all-time record on soybeans. The new ending stocks projection of USDA is now down 45 million bushels from the previous number. It stands at 910 million bushels. Brazil has cut their production by 5 million metric tons, expecting now 117 million metric tons of soybeans. Argentina's output number is down 0.5 million to 55 million tons. On the other side of the equation, Chinese soybean consumption was cut 3.5 million tons from the December figure, and imports were lowered another 2 million tons. At the close, March soybeans finished up 3.25 cents at 916 and a quarter. November, the new crop next fall, was up 2.75 cents at 958. We have three stories for you in this half hour. Anna Hastert is still a bit giddy from her trip to the National Cattlemen's Convention in New Orleans. She met up with the Hereford cattle folks and is now a convert to red and white and beef from the same cattle. Dustin Hoffman attended the Renewable Fuel Summit and talks about the challenges facing the ethanol industry, from the new administrator of EPA to getting E15 at the pump year-round. And after the State of the Union speech by President Trump highlighted rebuilding infrastructure as a possible bipartisan action in the next 2 years, I spoke with Mike Steenhawk, head of the Soy Transportation Coalition, about the likelihood of such. He is an intelligent and articulate man. You'll be able to clearly identify which of us is which in the interview.
Angels come to paint the desert nightly. When the moon is beaming brightly along the Santa Fe Trail, stardust scattered all along the highway on a rainbow-colored skyway along the Santa Fe Trail.
Iowa has been at the forefront of the renewable fuels industry since the late 1970s. All this got started when President Jimmy Carter said he was putting an embargo on grain shipments to the Soviet Union and that the grain would go into making gasohol fuel for American cars. Now, in that era, there had been an Arab oil embargo and there was a plentiful supply of corn. So Carter's idea, which proved to be a bust on keeping grain away from the Russians, did turn into the fledgling industry of distilling ethanol from corn. Jump to today, with the total production of ethanol is over 15 billion gallons per year and over one-tenth of the total U.S. motor fuel supply, the ethanol industry finds the same adversaries, the petroleum industry, and the same political problems, just larger. But the government continues to have the renewable fuel standard that requires blending ethanol with gasoline. Dustin Hoffman attended this year's Renewable Fuel Summit in Des Moines. Hello, Dustin.
Hello, Ken.
This year was the continuation of a long-running event with high-profile speakers. Do you agree?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were several leaders and you know, people who do research in ethanol production there this year. Governor Kim Reynolds came and addressed the audience. Also, Senator Chuck Grassley recorded a message for the those in attendance as well. It was a great time and a lot of education to be had for those who attended this year.
Well, the last year was tough on the ethanol industry. The head of the EPA, we'll remember, the agency which has oversight and governance on the renewable fuel standard, clearly was a friend of the petroleum industry. Scott Pruitt granted many waivers to small refineries. Was that addressed?
Yes, that it was. You know, the message that really came out during a lot of the keynote addresses was, if you look at where things were a year ago, a lot of good was gained. You know, a year ago, the ethanol industry was on the ropes. You had Senator Cruz, who was working to try to gut the RFS to the point that he was holding Bill Northey's appointment to the USDA hostage. He had Scott Pruitt was really helping them out by granting waivers to small refineries that were actually parts of large corporations that didn't need the waivers. You know, and they said in this last year they were on the ropes, but they fought back.
But do you know that actually Wheeler, the new acting administrator, has made any change to how that those waivers are given or how many are given?
You know, Acting Administrator Andrew Wheeler has said that he's going to do a better job, at least, you know, weighing the merits of these waivers. But he hasn't really gone so far as to say how many of them are going to be granted yet. But, you know, he's promising transparency in granting the waivers. And that was an interesting thing when that got brought up. Iowa Renewable Fuels Association Executive Director Monty Shaw, who's always good for a soundbite or two, made the comment that transparency in waivers, while is all fine and good, really doesn't solve the problem. He likened it to the old Western movies where the damsel in distress was tied to the railroad tracks, and you saw the train bearing down on them, and you hoped the hero would get to them in time to save them. And he said sometimes the damsel in distress was blindfolded and couldn't see the train coming, and sometimes her eyes were open and she could see the train coming. He said, I kind of find it hard to distinguish which one was better. Just because you can see the train coming doesn't mean it's going to hurt any less than if you can't see it coming.
That's a true Montyism right there. He has been good at that ever since he was in Washington and then came back to Iowa. The latest hope of the ethanol industry is to increase their market share with E15. That's a bigger blend of ethanol and gasoline. And they were shut down from that because it is only available at the pump at portions of the year. And EPA was supposed to change it to where it's available year-round. How's that coming?
You know, there's been some progress, maybe not enough, according to the ethanol industry. And this is something I've heard across the ethanol industry. You know, last summer at the state fair, Acting Administrator Andrew Wheeler came and was with Governor Reynolds, and they talked about how, well, we're getting close to an agreement. We've almost got something there. And then in October, President Trump was in Council Bluffs and makes the comments that he's directing the EPA to authorize E15 all year round, which we know means a rulemaking process. And, you know, we heard all summer that they were so close to having something, and now we're in February. We still don't have a rule being made, and the government shutdown slowed that down even more. And if they're wanting this done by the summer driving season, EPA really has to get on the horse. You know, Governor Reynolds said that she has been pushing Acting Administrator Wheeler to get that done and get it moving, because the clock is ticking. You need to have, I think, a 60-day comment period on a rule like that from the EPA. And if you're looking at a June 1st rollout to have it ready to go, you're really running up against the wire here for getting that done on time. You know, Growth Energy's Emily Score said that even though they're getting some wins in the ethanol industry, she said, we've got to keep on the offensive. We've got to keep pushing forward. We've got to keep riding this momentum that we've gotten in the latter half of 2018 to see the ethanol industry really be able to, you know, be able to reap the benefits of some of these things that changed during the last year.
Dustin Hoffman, our supervising editor for the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.
In our next segment, Mike Steenhawk addresses the immense task of rebuilding roads, bridges, and waterways, and the prospects of letting heavier trucks with more axles drive on interstate highways. We save Anna and her Herfordtitis for last. This is Weekend Ag Matters, a production of the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
There's more to crop insurance than protecting a crop. At Farm Credit Services of America, we know crop insurance is about protecting livelihoods, legacies, and a way of life. Crop insurance can be complex, but our goal of protecting you is simple. Discover the difference at Farm Credit Services of America. Agriculture works here.
Contact your local FCS America crop insurance specialist at 1-800-884-FARM.
Now, here again is Weekend Ag Matters host, Ken Root.
We can all agree that bridges across Iowa have seen better days. Weight limits don't match the equipment farmers use, and the roads are no better. Right now, Brazil is working to get one paved road that runs from their southern ports all the way to the Amazon. Our only advantage over many countries is our rural infrastructure, but we seem to treat it as a liability, not as an asset. Mike Steenhawk is with the Soy Transportation Coalition based in Ankeny. I spoke to him on Wednesday.
Well, we were very pleased to hear, you know, the call for infrastructure investment included in the speech. You know, one thing we recognize is that the State of the Union speech is very much prime real estate for the president and the administration. There are exponential number of things that could be included in that speech, a number of things that are priorities and of importance to the administration, and they're all vying for that, you know, critical amount of time in that limited speech. And so we appreciate that at least infrastructure investment was included, albeit it was brief. We obviously would like to hear more specifics and even more attention devoted to it. But that being said, we were happy to see it included, because I think the message is appropriate that if the administration and if Congress are truly interested in doing something that is bipartisan, that actually checks one of the boxes off the American people's to-do list, we think infrastructure investment is arguably the best opportunity to do that. And so I think it was great that it was included in that, in those remarks. So we're very hopeful that something will get done. Unfortunately, you know, the current environment in Washington, D.C. and all of the disagreements and the acrimony that we see and we witness has less to do with policy differences and has more to do with personality differences. And so, you know, we acknowledge that that doesn't bode well for getting actually something done. But I do think that it becomes all the more incumbent upon constituent groups like farmers and others to remind ourselves that we're actually the voters. We're the bosses, ultimately. And it's our right to go to our elected officials and say, hey, this is something that we actually need to have happen. This is something that's going to be benefiting our industry. And we really impress upon you to do something about it. One of the things that really frustrates me is that so many of these issues that are really creating this impasse, it has less to do with policy disagreements and more to do with personal disagreements. And they've been, and this is an indictment on both Republicans and Democrats, on the administration and Congress. I think there is blame to go around for all, that things have been allowed to get categorized as if I concede this, that means you get a win, and we've got to prevent that win at all costs. Even if what's being achieved will provide dramatic benefit to the American people, and this is not just transportation related, it's on a host of issues, and things have been allowed to get categorized, calcified that way. And so it's my hope that you can have people come and discuss infrastructure and say, and be able to get some adults in the room and say, look, I'm not going to get 100% of what I want, but let's move the ball. Let's check off one of the items on the American people's to-do list, and because that's more important than my own political posturing.
Mike Stienock, always good to have an intellectual discussion with you about emotional issues. Let's hope we can move ahead and the Soy Transportation Coalition can be a catalyst to getting this accomplished.
Thank you, Ken. It's always a pleasure.
Back with Anna Haster and a visit about the merits of Hereford cattle in a moment. This is Weekend Ag Matters. A lot of people love purebred livestock. My favorite when I was a child was horned Hereford cattle. I grew up on a farm, and my father worked at a Hereford ranch a few miles away, and by the time I was 6 years old, he let me go with him. And I developed a love for these Hereford cattle that I still have today. Anna Hastert has had a little experience with the Hereford breed in America. Hello, Anna.
Good morning, Ken.
Tell me, when did you have your brush with Herefords?
Yeah, so in high school, I took several agriculture classes, and we learned about the different breeds of cattle, swine, you name it. So I learned a little bit about the breed then, but it was actually during my high school career that I had gotten the opportunity to actually show cattle for a family that owned Pulled Hereford. So still in that Hereford bloodline there. And that was a great opportunity. I had never shown at the state fair before, but they had really great cattle to work with. I went out there quite frequently throughout the spring months to work with the cattle, get acquainted with them. Just really easy breed to work with and caused no complications for me during the state fair showing, which was a little bit different than I was used to by showing some Simmental Angus at the county fair. So a really great experience and really great breed to work with. Very much so, Ken. There's no way for me to even explain the differences between the two because it's surprisingly, even though they're both beef breeds, it's surprising and vastly different.
You know, what you're saying is very true in that Herefords, which are one of the British breeds, are pretty docile. And they're not that big, and till of late when they've been crossbreeding them. But once you bring in those continental breeds, you can get a steer that can be extremely large. I think of some of these Hereford Angus crosses of the past that weren't that big, and I think of some of the Hereford Chianina crosses that you could hardly reach their back. And those animals were a little more rowdy, weren't they?
Very much so, Ken. There's no way for me to even explain the differences between the two, because it's surprisingly, even though they're both beef breeds, it's surprising and vastly different.
Well, let's talk about the Hereford breed and success they had this past year, because, you know, most people said for a while they and Angus were just going to be the cross. That's all they were going to be. But yet you have to have that base breed itself. So how are they doing individually?
Yeah, so I had the opportunity during the 2019 Cattle Industry Convention and National Cattlemen's Beef Association Trade Show, which was in New Orleans last week, to talk to the Chief Operating Officer and Director of Breed Improvement for the American Hereford Association. His name was Shane Bedwell, and had a really great conversation with him. We started the conversation out talking about some of those successes that they experienced in 2018, and some of those that he noted that are really, really stand out here is all sectors were up for them, and beef demand was incredible. Everything was kind of going their way, and he anticipates this success to pick up here in 2019 as well.
What do you think we can expect from Herefords in 2019?
Well, Shane Bedwell thinks that we can expect the same growth in 2019. He said a lot of people are excited about this breed of cattle, and they're seeing more people joining their association. They're getting more young members and adult members, and the number of Hereford cattle that are registered throughout the United States has also grown with that within the past year. So he expects that growth and that improvement to continue into this new year as well. And he's also excited to see what happens on the genetics end. He talked about the importance of maternal heterosis, so keeping back those females that have been the product of the first crossbred of your Hereford and another breed that you have on your farm, and then keeping those heifers back and using their qualities in to populate the next generation and just improving those genetics and those bloodlines. Another exciting thing that's happening with American Hereford is they're changing some of their specifications when it comes to their certified Hereford beef program. They've seen really great improvement in cattle over the past couple of years in regards to genetic. They're seeing a significant increase in grading potential, which is now averaging over 80% choice. And the consumers are demanding that higher quality product as well. So their board of directors approved to change the marbling spec a little bit to small zero, which is the lower end of their spec. And they also added an upper two-thirds premium of certified Hereford beef. That was made in 2017, and so far it's been the fastest growing branded product that they offer, and it's projected to over 12 million in 2019. So here's what Shane Bedwell has to say about why they're making those changes in regards to the product that they offer and what they think that can offer to consumers here in 2019.
It was time to offer the same tenderness, flavor, juiciness that certified Hereford beef had in the early days, that heritage of that great tasting beef, but add that quality to it and that consistency.
Technology and the advances that it's brought to producers is just amazing. And I learned about a lot of those different technologies that are being implemented and farmers' operations at that trade show last week. And it just amazes me every time I learn about some new product.
Anna, thank you very much for that work and for traveling to the National Cattlemen's Association and reporting on their event. I do have one last thing to say about Herefords. A few years ago at the Iowa State Fair, I was asked if I would like to show a low-line Hereford, and I didn't know what that meant, but those are the miniatures of the cattle, and so I thought that would be fun. I went in and I showed this bull calf, and it was fun to show him, but he was the same size as the cattle were when I was a boy. The Hereford breed that's now the low-line miniatures is actually what they used to be. They have just grown them so much larger now that they're literally like another breed.
The cattle are prowling, the coyotes are howling, way out where the dog is born. Where spurs are jingling, a cowboy is singing.
That's our half hour for this weekend. We sure appreciate you joining us. Our email address is kenroot@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of the show and what you'd like to have on it. The Agribusiness Association of Iowa will have their big showcase event next week in Des Moines. Dustin and Anna will both cover it. Commodity Classic is at the end of the month in Orlando, and I have volunteered to go to that meeting. Stay warm. You've been listening to Weekend Ag Matters, a production of the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.